Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the reading of the Courier-Journal for this Monday, May 8th, which is brought to our Louisville listeners via Louisville Public Media. And as you know, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Your reader for today is Rod Brotherton. And let's look at the week ahead in weather. We're going to get the April showers in May, it looks like. Today, high 83, rain, and a p.m. thunderstorm. Tonight, low 64, another thunderstorm or two in the early evening. Tuesday, high 80, low 61, humid, and an afternoon thunderstorm. Wednesday, high 83, low 61, mostly sunny and warm. Thursday, warm and increased cloudiness with a high of 80 and a low of 65. Friday, cloudy with a thunderstorm in spots. And Saturday, high 84, low 65, cloudy, and an afternoon thunderstorm. Looking at the almanac, yesterday's high and low, 78 and 51, with a normal of 75 and 55. The record high was 94 in 1959, and the record low, 36 in 1954. Precipitation on Friday, nothing. Month-to-date, just a trace, 9.3. Year-to-date, we've had 17.84 inches, with normal being 17.13. For the sun and the moon, the sun rose this morning at 6.39. It will set this evening at 8.40. While the moon is already up and won't rise, it will set at 8.34 this morning. Looking at our weather history, a rare late-season snowstorm on this date in 1803 ruined many of Philadelphia's shade trees. Snow accumulation from Indiana to New England during the storm's two-week trek. Now let's turn to the headlines. And on the front page, governor candidate focus is on ideas. Ryan Quarles, remember wanting to be governor of Kentucky since he was 6 years old, growing up on his family's tobacco and cattle farm in Scott County. One of the farms that we worked on when I was a little kid was within eyesight of the Capitol, Quarles said. I don't come from a political family, but I thought that maybe one day I'd be able to run for office. So this has been a lifelong dream of mine. Quarles, nearly through with his second term as Kentucky Agricultural Commissioner, is running to make that dream a reality in November, just after his 40th birthday. But to get to the general election and take on Democratic Governor Beshear, he has to get through the Republican primary on May 16th, a race where his campaign has been greatly outspent by two rival candidates, and their PACs have blanketed the state with TV ads for months. Attorney General Daniel Cameron has led the GOP PAC of gubernatorial candidates in the only independent polling conducted of the race this year, buoyed by name identification and an endorsement from former President Trump. Kelly Craft, Trump's former United Nations ambassador, had gained significant ground on Cameron in a poll released 3 weeks ago, thanks in large part to the $8.5 million she and her husband, billionaire coal CEO Joe Kraft, had pumped into her campaign and PAC to have ads on TV almost continuously since Christmas. Political observers have been skeptical of Quarles' chances in the GOP primary, not having the advantages of a Trump tie or personal wealth, and not putting up his first TV ad until 3 weeks ahead of the election. But according to Quarles and those close to him, the campaign has been methodically building momentum with a strategy and style that matches his characteristics, laying a foundation to victory from tireless grassroots work. In regular emails to campaign supporters this year, Quarles updates them on the thousands of miles he's driven through the dozen-plus counties that week in his big red truck, logging the number of flat tires he's personally changed, and county GOP dinners and luncheons where he's given his stump speech. Quarles, who boasts his background in farming, along with seven college degrees, says it's this hard work that will deliver him a primary victory and makes him the best candidate to take on Beshear in the fall. I've spent my life being driven, being results-oriented, and I've developed a work ethic that, quite frankly, is what's needed in a candidate to win this governor's race, Quarles said. Senate Majority Leader Damon Thayer, Republican of Georgetown, has watched Quarles rise in Kentucky's politics since its beginning in 2004 when the University of Kentucky student served as his first Senate intern and then ran his campaign that fall. It's going to be hard for anybody to outwork him, said Thayer, who considers Quarles both his protege and one of his closest friends. Whatever he does, he throws himself into it to the point where it becomes all-consuming. Working on his family farm to pay his way through school, Quarles had graduated with a triple major and earned two graduate degrees from UK by the age of 23, and then added another graduate degree from Harvard and a law degree from UK by 2010. He also ran for a seat in the Kentucky General Assembly that year and scored an upset victory over a longtime Democratic incumbent, becoming the youngest member of the legislature at just 27. After winning re-election twice, Quarles ran for commissioner of the Department of Agriculture in 2015, eking out a GOP primary victory before winning the general election at 32. Before easily winning a second term to the office in 2019, Quarles picked up his seventh post-secondary degree, a doctorate in education, from Vanderbilt University. Quarles says his work ethic and ambition in public service and higher education stems from his parents. His dad was active with the Kentucky Farm Bureau and Burley Tobacco Growers Cooperative, while his mother was a public school teacher who went back to school to earn her doctorate and then taught nursing at Kentucky State University. He says his mother, Bonnie, put the fear of God into me when it came to his studies, saying he'd either have to stay and work in the tobacco fields or go to college, which he would have to pay for himself. I took 27 credit hours a semester. I was motivated, Quarles said, adding that when most people spent Friday and Saturday socializing, I was in class. Quarles said his last degree at Vanderbilt was in memory of my mom who died from cancer 10 years ago. When it comes to politics, there's not much daylight between Quarles and his main rivals in the Republican primary. Like Cameron and Kraft, Quarles is unmistakably conservative, touting his opposition to abortion, gun regulations, and the policies of the Beshear administration. Chief among them, Beshear's regulations restricting businesses and schools during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. Where Quarles differentiates himself is in his tactics and rhetoric, making a concerted effort since day one of his campaign to avoid attacking his fellow GOP candidates while laying off the buzzwords that are red meat for conservatives in this political era. While much of the TV ads for Kraft and Cameron have attacked each other, Quarles has focused his criticism on Beshear and left his opponents alone, saying that's a reflection of how he was raised and an effective primary strategy. I would love to see a governor's race, for once in our lifetime, being about who has the best ideas and not who has the biggest insults, said Quarles, who added that lobbing grenades is not a good way to unite the party that must be united if it's going to win. Thayer, who said he's voting for Quarles, but not publicly endorsing him, added that Quarles is not a fire and brimstone Republican who has a natural hand to hand brawler like past GOP officials such as Larry Forgy or David Williams, though he said he is confident Quarles will spare no mercy for Beshear and the general. Quarles also has touted himself as the ideas candidate, releasing his policy for specific issues each week since February, ranging from medical marijuana to public safety in Louisville to education. Whereas Cameron and Kraft have particularly thrown out red meat rhetoric on the topic of education, the latter making a cartoonish and showing purple-haired woke bureaucrats parachuting into Kentucky schools to teach students pronouns and critical race theory. Quarles has been more reluctant. In an 800-word op-ed outlining his education policy, Quarles mentioned the need for improving vocational training, student discipline, and teacher training and recruitment, but he did not mention CRT, pronouns, transgender kids, or anything woke. However, Quarles has not separated himself from conservative stances on such social issues. He has criticized Beshear in front of GOP audiences for vetoing a bill prohibiting transgender girls from girl sports, as well as another wide-ranging bill passed this year targeting trans youth, which includes a ban on hormone therapy for transgender children, forces trans students to use the bathroom of their gender at birth, and allows teachers to misgender trans students. Quarles has also resisted calls for a red flag law to restrict guns from those deemed by a judge to be an immediate threat to themselves and others, while opposing a change to Kentucky's near-total abortion ban to add exceptions in cases of rape and incest. And then there's Trump. While Cameron's campaign has led with his endorsement by Trump, Quarles has touted his endorsements from 235 local elected GOP officials, including more than one-fourth of county judge executives and 100 county magistrates. Quarles said the endorsement of those local officials will carry more weight than Trump's in the primary, as they will be stepping up to help us get across the finish line, especially in a low turnout election. Though a recent poll of Kentucky Republicans found Trump's trouncing Florida Governor Ron DeSantis as a potential 2024 GOP presidential primary matchup, Quarles said in one debate he'd back the governor over Trump as he is ready for prime time. Quarles added the caveat that Trump was better than Joe Biden and deserves a second chance. One of Quarles' big first breaks was an internship with the Washington office of Senator Mitch McConnell, who supported him in past races. Though the senator, whose name adorns the Republican Party of Kentucky's headquarters, remains neutral in the current primary. Asked who he would consider his political idol, Quarles did not choose McConnell, whose popularity among Kentucky Republicans has plummeted in the Trump era, instead picking Abraham Lincoln, a fellow Kentucky farm boy. "He and I both grew up without any means, worked our way through life," Quarles said. "We both valued education to the point where we took ourselves to extremes when it comes to studying." Thayer said he and others have at times urged Quarles to take a real vacation and unplug, but he added, "I wouldn't want to change him. This is what makes him uniquely qualified to go up against Beshear and to be governor," Thayer said. "I can't think of anybody more well-prepared than him or more dedicated to doing the job." If elected, Quarles would be only the second governor in Kentucky history and one of only two current state governors to have never been married. Friends say his marital status, a regular suspect of friendly ribbing at the annual Fancy Farm picnic, is largely a result of his demanding schedule, along with the fact that he's been in the public eye as an elected official at such a young age. While Thayer says he sometimes teases Quarles about his 7 degrees, the Department of Agriculture inspection stickers on gas pumps started identifying him as Dr. Ryan Quarles last year, and he adds that he's still uniquely relatable with people. A lot of people who get these higher ed degrees aren't certainly necessary the most relatable people, but when Ryan walks around in his jeans and flannel shirt and scuffed up boots, it's not an act, Thayer said. That's the Ryan I've always known. His campaign's first TV ad that started running last week, Quarles is seen riding his tractor at a farm and whose same boots and flannel shirt, telling the viewer he would be honored to have his vote. If you're ready for a governor that thinks like you because they were raised like you. His connection with rural Kentuckians through his 7+ years crisscrossing the state as agricultural commissioner is one of the reasons Quarles considers himself the most electable Republican in the general election. Saying he can allow the GOP to run up the score on Beshear in those areas while keeping it relatively close in more urban areas. In a close general election race, it may come down to suburban areas, which broke heavily for Beshear in 2019, giving him a narrow margin over former Governor Matt Bevin. Last month, at a Texas roadhouse in a strip mall on the outskirts of Bowling Green, one of those aforementioned suburban areas, a couple approached Quarles to reconnect with him, indicating their support in the primary. "Hey, rural Kentucky is going to win this race," Quarles told them. "It's been 20 years since we had a governor from rural Kentucky. Just get the farm vote out for me. Don't forget." Our next story. Do the weapon detectors JCPS is considering work? Jefferson County Public School Board members are poised to move forward in the process to spend nearly $20 million on security equipment that has been problematic for other districts and without adequate time to witness how the equipment actually operates. Weapons detection equipment manufactured by the Evolve Express will be on display at Butler High from Monday to May 19th, but board members have chosen to call a special meeting Tuesday to vote on whether to start procurement process for weapons detectors themselves, given the community just one day to see the process. Weapon detectors are different than a metal detector, as they use artificial intelligence to scan large crowds and don't require bags or pockets to be emptied. The technology is meant to streamline the security process, but there are limitations to when and what the scanners will pick up. At one New York school, a student was able to pass through an Evolve scanner with a knife in his backpack, which he ultimately used to stab another student. In another incident within the same district, an off-duty officer accidentally brought a revolver through a scanner without triggering an alarm. Additionally, there have been numerous complaints about the logistical issues caused by a high rate of false alarms, which leads to students being physically searched. Currently, the reality is that weapons of mass instruction set off almost every child as they walk through, one North Carolina principal wrote in an email a month after the Evolve scanners were installed. If you have multiple binders or spiral notebooks in your bag, then it lights up and we must search. Today was probably the least safe day at our school, as all hands were at the front doors instead of monitoring kids throughout the building, the principal added. JCPS board members asked Superintendent Marty Pollo and his team to look into purchasing metal detectors for the district's middle and high schools in February, shortly after a gun was found at Eastern High School. At that time, JCPS had reported 20 incidents of possession of handguns this school year, but that number has increased. Just last week, a student at Iroquois High was found with a gun. Polio's team chose to present the board findings on weapon detectors rather than metal detectors after visiting three school districts using the Evolve equipment, including the district in North Carolina where the principal referred to common schooled items brought through scanners as weapons of mass instruction. Evolve scanners are used in about 200 schools across the country, as well as large arenas, according to its website. JCPS was able to organize the two-week display of the equipment at Butler because the scanners will be used at Churchill Downs during Kentucky Derby week, according to JCPS spokeswoman Carolyn Callahan. JCPS Chief of Staff Katie DeFari told the board the scanners would pick up on guns and small explosives, but not small pocket knives. Like any security measure, there will be limitations, she said. But the perks of these scanners versus metal detectors include efficacy and eliminating human bias that often leads to more physical searches for students of color. We don't want to be invasive or search things that don't need to be searched, DeFari said, adding that the weapons technology detection is an objective screening process. If installed, scanners would first go into half of the district's high schools this fall. Students would place their Chromebooks at a table ahead of the scanner, which would be handed back to them after passing through. If the scanner gives an alert that a student is potentially carrying a weapon, a school staff member would be responsible for the secondary search. Each school would have an armed, sworn officer in the building in case the student is found to have a weapon. A decision about staffing the scanners still needs to be made. The district can hire part-time staffers on contract, or administrators can just morning duties in their school so current staffers can monitor the process. Given the shortage of officers in the district's police force, along with the shortage of officers within Louisville's Metro Police, ensuring an armed officer is in a building each morning is another challenge the district would need to overcome to implement the plan. The swing between not detecting actual weapons to falsely alerting on school materials has to do with the different settings level schools can set the Evolve scanners to, according to Don May, the head of operations for the tech firm IPVM, which has investigated Evolve's equipment and marketing strategies. Evolve scanners have sensitivity settings ranging from A through F, with F being the most sensitive. The most sensitive setting will detect most guns, but it is far more likely to also alert things like three-ring binders and lunch boxes as potential weapons at that setting. Thus, schools are put in a predicament where they must weigh safety against the efficiency, May explained. Evolve did not respond to a request for comment by the Courier-Journal. Anecdotally, districts have expressed their belief that the scanners do effectively work as a deterrent for students considering bringing a weapon to school. DeFari said that in the Charlotte district, there were more than 30 weapons found in the school that year before the scanners were installed, and since there have been three. Another issue districts should consider, May said, is whether or not teachers and administrators should be deployed to work as security professionals. If the scanner detects a potential weapon, a secondary search is the responsibility of a school staff member, an intentional decision made by JCPS to ensure the search is done by a person who has a relationship with the kids, DeFari said. If I were a teacher or an administrator, I'd be asking myself, is this what I'm trained to do? May said. Is that interaction with a student that's potentially carrying a weapon one that I should be having? Board members were set to simply see a presentation about this equipment during their April meeting. But District 2's James Craig pushed for a vote to allow DeFurry's team to keep moving forward in the process to purchase weapon detectors and set up the special called meeting for Thursday, for Tuesday. It's more of a demonstration to the community of what has to happen, Craig said about why he supports the board making a decision about this technology just one day into it being on display. I have a strong sense of urgency about this, he added. Only two board members, District 2's Chris Kolb and District 4's Joe Marshall, voted against the measure. Kolb's dissenting vote was due to a lack of research showing the effectiveness of this technology, the staffing crisis this system is already experiencing, and the fact that this technology does nothing to stop an intruder who enters a building brandishing a weapon with the intent of a mass shooting. It disturbs me a little bit that the board is considering spending $17 million or something with little to no research behind it, and the research that does exist is mixed at best, Kolb said. As for Marshall, I voted no, as not to rush the spending of $17 million on an initiative that on the surface looks good, but in the end has no concrete data emphasizing its effectiveness, he wrote in an email to the Courier Journal. If we have additional dollars to spend, we need to explore bonuses or hazard pay for our special alternative school staff to ensure those buildings have high-quality staffing. The $17 million figure given to board members is based on years-long contracts with Evolve has with similar-sized districts, Callahan said. If board members vote to move forward, the district would issue requests for proposals from multiple vendors before entering a contract. If the scanners are installed, DeFari stressed that they will not replace any of the district's current safety measures. Adults and student relationships will continue to be paramount in maintaining safety in our schools and in implementing these systems, according to slides from her presentation. Effective building supervision and adherence to current safety protocols would continue to support a successful and holistic approach to campus safety. Additionally, Superintendent Poyo pointed out, the scanners will have little to no impact on the rate at which young people in the community are able to get guns. One alarming statistic is that machine gun diversion devices are becoming far more prevalent in Louisville, and of those confiscated last year, about 75% were on juveniles. Polio has told a story on repeated occasions, recently of being told by a student that it's easier to get a handgun in Louisville than it is to get a pack of cigarettes. If the board chooses, we will implement this, but with the access kids have to handguns in our communities, this is something we can do, but it will not stop until the community does something, he said. Finally, rallygoers in Pakistan kill a man accused of blasphemy. Rallygoers for a political party in Pakistan beat to death a participant for allegedly making a blasphemous speech, police said Sunday. Some of his words in his prayer were deemed blasphemous by a number of protesters, leading to the torture and death at the hands of the angry mob. And this concludes readings for the first section of the Courier Journal for this Monday, May 8th. Stay tuned for the Metro section to follow immediately. Your reader has been Rod Brotherton.
Now to continue reading from the Courier Journal. For Monday, May 8th, we turn to the Metro section. Your reader is Vicki Trupiano. We read the obituaries first. We read the name, the age, and the location. If you would like further information on any of the obituaries, please call us during the weekdays at 859-422-6390, and we'll be glad to read the entire obituary for you. I'll repeat that number at the end of the listings. And please forgive any mispronunciations during this reading. Thank you. William Anderson, 79, Corydon. Elizabeth Belasa, 92, Louisville. Kitchell Barrett, 60, New Albany, Indiana. Joyce A. Brown, 69, Jeffersonville. Glenn E. Butler, 59, Louisville. Kevin W. Campbell, 67, Fern Creek. Charles A. Carruthers, 72, Elizabethtown. Robert Frey, 46, Marysville. Amy Lynn Graves, 40, Louisville. Wanda Hansen, 80, Okolona. Lori Holt, 40, New Albany. Elizabeth Hudson, 40, Louisville. Wilma J. Jagers, 73, Shelbyville. Michael J. Kelly, 61, Louisville. Jean Knuckles, 77, Louisville. Montrude H. Lanham, 88, Gravel Switch. Pauline Polly Middleton, 93, Jeffersonville. Stella Marie Perkins, 91, Louisville. Nicholas G. Reichert, 37, Clarksville. Kirk Douglas Sparks, 51, Charlestown. Lois Stewart, 87, Louisville. Elizabeth Stewart, 87, Louisville. Albert Dwight Tooley, 76, Sacramento. Ernest Tipton Whitus Sr., 89, no location. Jackie Woodard, 53, Louisville. Again, if you would like further information on any of the obituaries, please call us during the weekdays at 859-422-6390, and we'll be glad to read the entire item to you. In our first article from the Metro section, Rivian invests $10 million in Shepherdsville. EV manufacturer looks to add 218 full-time jobs. And this is from Olivia Evans, Louisville Courier-Journal, USA Today Network. The electric vehicle manufacturing industry continues to grow across the Commonwealth. Rivian, an electric vehicle manufacturer that builds sport utility vehicles and trucks, will invest $10 million in Bullitt County to establish a facility growth and create 218 full-time jobs. Kentucky's manufacturing and EV industries have seen unprecedented growth recently, Governor Andy Beshear said in a press release. Continued investment in our key industries is critical for our immediate and long-term economic success. Rivian is an outstanding company that has been a major player in our state's manufacturing and EV sectors. And this expansion is an exciting next step for the company here in the Commonwealth. The automotive company, founded in 2009, already has parts operations inside a 326,000-square-foot facility in Shepherdsville. This investment will allow the company to update the facility to include a remanufacturing facility where employees will reconstruct vehicle parts, such as electrical hardware, drive units, and battery systems. We're thrilled to be working with the state of Kentucky to help develop and expand Rivian's first facility within the state, said Jimmy Knopf, Rivian's Executive Vice President of Facilities. Our new site in Shepherdsville will support multiple business-critical functions for Rivian and help bring good-paying jobs and training for Kentuckians in the region. The Kentucky Economic Development Finance Authority has approved a 10-year incentive program with Rivian through the Kentucky Business Investment Program, which can provide tax incentives based on the company's $10 million investment and job and wage targets. Rivian will also be eligible for tax incentives through the Kentucky Enterprise Initiative Act, which allows companies to recoup Kentucky sales and use tax on construction costs, building fixtures, equipment use in research, and development and electronic processing. Since 2020, Kentucky has seen more than $10 billion in EV-related investments, creating roughly 10,000 jobs in the state, including the Blue Oval SK Battery Park, a joint venture between Ford Motor Company and SK On Innocent Elements, a sustainable battery material production plant in Hopkinsville. Contact reporter Olivia Evans at oevans@courier-journal.com. In the next article, Louisville Libraries Earn National Award. Mobile Newsroom Project Leads to Honor. And this is from Bailey Loosemore of the Louisville Courier Journal. Louisville Free Public Library has been named a top innovator nationally for its role in hosting the Courier Journal's Mobile Newsroom, a program that sends journalists to different branches to learn how they can better cover the city's diverse communities. The award comes from the Urban Libraries Council, which annually honors libraries that showcase creative thinking and out-of-the-box application of library resources, according to a press release. For 2023, LFPL was selected as an innovator for advocacy and awareness, one of eight award categories. We applaud Louisville Free Public Library for their visionary program, which will revolutionize their library and community and serve as a template for public libraries across North America, ULC President and CEO Brooks Rainwater said in the release. Courier Journal reporters and editors visited five libraries as part of its mobile newsroom in 2022, spending up to 4 weeks at each branch. The program produced more than 40 stories on people, businesses, and issues within the branch's neighborhood, including a look at how Hispanic residents are revitalizing Preston Highway and why many apartments at one large complex remained vacant. It also engaged residents civically through in-person JCPS school board candidate forums and op-ed workshops led by opinion editor Bonnie Feldkamp. Louisville Free Public Library branches were the obvious choice for our mobile newsroom, Courier Journal executive editor Mary Irby Jones said. Our libraries serve all segments of our community, and we know that the partnership would allow us to temporarily set up shops in parts of our community that we wanted to do a better job of listening to and covering. We found these residents eager to stop by and meet our journalists, as well as to share their stories and offer story ideas. The Courier Journal will resume the mobile newsroom in June at the Oldham County Public Library, LaGrange branch. Other locations in 2023 will include libraries in Shawnee, Jeffersontown, and Fairdale. You can reach reporter Bailey Loosemore at bloosemore@courierjournal.com or 502-582-4646. Congratulations to Louisville Libraries. As a retired public librarian, that's wonderful to hear things like this. Moving on, nonprofits. Budget doesn't do enough to help renters. Groups ask for $16 million for more rent assistance, and this is from Bailey Loosemore. Nonprofit leaders say Louisville is not doing enough to prevent evictions as the number of local filings surpasses pre-pandemic levels. At a press conference Tuesday, representatives from several housing-related organizations called on elected officials to dedicate at least $16 million toward rent assistance and other programs in the upcoming fiscal budget, a figure that doubles what Mayor Craig Greenberg recently proposed. We've been telling them that the federal funds were going to dry up and that there needed to be a plan before that happened, and they have done nothing, said Celine Mutayimartia, organizing director of the Black Leadership Action Coalition of Kentucky, referencing more than $125 million in rent and utility assistance distributed by Louisville through the COVID-19 pandemic. We need the commitment of the $16 million to demonstrate a good faith effort from elected officials. In his first budget address, Greenberg called housing a critical issue for Louisville and proposed spending $8 million on rent assistance and home repairs, along with $15 million on affordable housing construction. His budget also includes funding for a community care campus that will provide medical services and temporary housing for homeless people, as well as money to continue the Hope Village, a safe outdoor space that opened in 2022. And I recall we've covered these issues. These issues have been covered in the newspaper. In an email, Major Spokesman Kevin Traeger said Greenberg's budget includes $24.9 million total in new direct spending on affordable housing and homelessness. Currently, the Metro Council is scheduling budget hearings as they work towards finalizing the budget before July 1st, and we encourage community members to be involved in the process through these budget hearings, Traeger said. Nonprofit leaders say all the services outlined by the mayor are needed, but with eviction filings continuing to rise, more money is needed to keep people in the homes they already have. According to data from Kentucky's Administrative Office of the Courts, more than 5,500 evictions were filed in Jefferson County in the first 4 months of 2023, topping the nearly 5,300 evictions filed in the first 4 months of 2019. The only defense to an eviction for non-payment of rent is payment, said Stuart Pope, Director of Advocacy for the Legal Aid Society, which provides free representation for low-income residents. Rental assistance is vital for us to be able to negotiate settlement with landlords and keep people housed. In addition to more funding for rent assistance, speakers on Tuesday called for extra spending on eviction mediation, outreach, and security deposits. Ronnie Morris, an organizer with Vocal Kentucky, who was homeless for 15 years before receiving a subsidized housing voucher, said Louisville can make such programs a priority if it reduced spending on police and incarceration. They can give us the money that we need, Morris said of elected officials. They want to push for police to have a gym, and they want to push for other things that don't help our houseless community and our low-income community and the people that may have mental health issues. We don't need a new jail. We need housing. Residents are invited to provide input on Louisville's budget through an online form at louisvillekydoubleufo.com/forms/ZLD6KY3VIQ239K. That's the website. Community members can also share input in person at a meeting at 6 p.m. May 30th in the Metro Council Chambers at 601 West Jefferson Street. Speakers must sign up beginning at 5:30 p.m. and will have 3 minutes each to address council members. Again, that's May 30th at 6 p.m. in the Metro Council Chambers. Reach reporter Bailey Loosemore at BLOOSEMORE@courier-journal.com or 502-582-4646. Here's an interesting article in the education department area. By the numbers, which JCPS elementary, middle, and high schools receive the most funding? And this is from Krista Johnson of the Louisville Courier Journal. This story is one of several the Courier Journal will be publishing in the coming weeks focused on funding within Jefferson County Public Schools. Our hope is to give the community more information on how school finance works and to create discussions surrounding how Kentucky's largest district spends its money. With nearly 100,000 students, 17,000 staff members, and about 200 buildings, Jefferson County Public Schools operates with a nearly $1.4 billion annual budget made up of federal, state, and local funds. While most of those funds are allocated to schools based on enrollment, there are several factors that lead to some schools having a higher rate of funding compared to others. The range starts at just under $12,000 per student at one school and goes up to nearly $23,000 per student at another, according to the district's reporting in 2020-2021 of 133 schools. Federal funds make up a small portion, 0.5%, of the budget and are the most stringent source of income for the district, while local funds, 60% of the budget, are far more flexible when it comes to distribution. State funds flow to the district based on its enrollment and staffing and the demographics of its students. The district receives additional money for students with disabilities and those learning English, among other things. Funding from the state is sent to JCPS, and the district then chooses how to distribute it across schools. The average amount of federal funding that JCPS spends per student is $2,016, compared to $13,644 in state and local money. About 67% of JCPS students were considered economically disadvantaged in 2020-21, a federal designation indicating the student qualifies for free or reduced lunch. That rate was far higher in some JCPS schools, though, with the highest rate at about 95%. Generally speaking, schools with a higher rate of students considered economically disadvantaged receive a higher amount of funding because data shows additional money is necessary to close the large achievement gap between students living in poverty and those who are not. There are, however, some outliers. Look below to see which elementary, middle, and high schools that received the highest funding levels. I'll read those now. Atkinson Academy, federal dollars, $3,580 per student, state and local dollars, $19,384 per student, totaling $22,964. Atkinson is an elementary school in West Louisville, with 320 students, of which 91% were considered economically disadvantaged. It is the highest funded school in the district. Of its students, 23% had disabilities and 1% were English language learners. The majority of its spending was on staff, which is not uncommon, though its rate of staff spending was far higher than the average among elementary schools. Of the $22,964 spent per student, $20,562 was on staff. The school had 32 teachers with a 10-to-1 student ratio. Of the group, 40% hold a master's degree, which higher rate of pay. Despite the high rate of funding, Atkinson students did not perform well on state assessments, with 12.5% considered proficient readers and less than 10% considered proficient in math. Only three other elementary schools spent more than $22,000 per student: Breckenridge Franklin, Fraser, and Young. About 85% of students at each school were considered economically disadvantaged. As a system, the average amount of dollars spent per elementary student was $14,833, $1,907 of which were federal. The elementary school that spent the least per student was Great House Shyrock Traditional at $12,772. At that school, 22.5% were economically disadvantaged, 38.4% were proficient readers, and 35.5% were proficient in math. Knight Middle, federal dollars, $2,168 per student. State and local dollars, $14,609 per student, a total of $16,777. Knight was the highest-funded traditional 6-8 middle school in the district in 2020-2021. The South Central School served 458 students, 76% of whom were economically disadvantaged, 19% had disabilities, and 7% were learning English as a second language. As a district, the average rate of funding for middle schools was $14,313, significantly less than Knight's $16,777 per student. Knight also had the highest rate of state and local funds going towards staff, $13,525. The school had 33 teachers and 43% had master's degrees. In terms of academic performance, 21% of Knight students were proficient readers and less than 10% were proficient in math, according to state assessments. Only one other middle school spent more than $16,000 per student, Frederick Law Olmsted Academy North, where 83% of students were economically disadvantaged. The Academy at Shawnee. Federal dollars, $2,711 per student. State and local dollars, $19,074 per student, totaling $21,785. Aside from just a few elementary schools, the Academy at Shawnee in Western Louisville received far more funding than all district schools. Elementary schools often receive more money due to the need for smaller class sizes and additional classroom aides. Of the elementary schools included in this report, only 6 spent more than $21,000 per student. Shawnee, a 6-12 grade school, is the only upper grade school to fall into that category. With 529 students, it also had the highest rate of impoverished students among middle and high schools, at 88%. As a school, very few students, about 1%, were English language learners, and about 23% had disabilities. Shawnee is the only school in the district that offers the Federal Aviation Regulations, FAR, private pilot license course. Its other magnet programs focus on health and human services, automation engineering, graphic design, and aircraft maintenance. Of its 42 teachers, 35% held master's degrees and 5% had certifications in special areas, compared to just 2.8% across the district. As far as state assessments, just 16% of Shawnee High School students were proficient readers, and less than 10% were proficient in math. You can contact reporter Krista Johnson at kjohnson3@gannett.com. We have a few minutes left, and Dahlia Gabor contributed an article, So Long, Farewell, 5 Restaurants Close in 1 Week in Louisville. Though a flurry of restaurants ready to open their doors before the 149th Kentucky Derby, not everyone had the same luck. In the last few days, 5 different Louisville restaurants announced permanent closures, including the Colonial Gardens location of Taco Lucador, which has 3 other locations in Louisville. Take a look below at the restaurants we're saying goodbye to this month. No one we missed, send a note to dghabour@gannett.com. All tied up, 211 South 5th Street, Burger IM, 3733 Lexington Road, Frisch's Big Boy, 804 Housefelt Lane, New Albany, Indiana. The Green Right, 1001 Logan Street. And Taco Lucador, 5205 Newcut Road. There's information on each of the restaurants that I just read, and we don't have enough time to go through all of them, but I'll read what we have time for. All Tied Up is a popular Thai food truck which closed its brick-and-mortar restaurant in downtown Louisville on May 4th. Catherine F. Vallivont, I can't pronounce her last name, A-P-H-A-I-V-O-N-G-S, I don't want to ruin it, originally opened the restaurant in January of 2022. As much as we wanted downtown to work out, we have decided we need to move on, she wrote on Facebook. We have enjoyed serving you and are thankful for your patronage. Our lunches were busy, but that alone isn't sustainable. Thank you and stay tuned for our next chapter. The food truck will still be out and about. All Tied Up serves classic Thai noodle dishes like pad thai and pad siu, rice bowl curries, fried spring rolls, and boba tea. Unlike other Asian fusion concepts, the chef cooks authentic, spicy Thai food that she grew up eating and cooking in Thailand. She makes pad thai, of course, but she serves it Thai style, neutral with peppers and peanuts on the side. Her basil stir-fry or pad krill roh gai is made with fresh Thai chilies, Thai basil, and a 3-chili spice warning on the menu. Burger I.M. Chain burger restaurant Burger I.M. closed suddenly on May 1st. Management confirmed the closure with a post on Facebook. Thank you, Louisville, for the immense support we have received over the years, they wrote. The restaurant said 20% of the sales over the last few days of operation would be donated to Louisville Frontlines Teachers Fund and School Lunch Meal Payment Program. Burger I.M. served 1/3 pound and 1/4 pound fresh, never frozen Angus beef burgers, grilled chicken sandwiches, falafel, Greek lamb, milkshakes, and more. Frisch's Big Boy. The New Albany, Indiana location of this diner closed in late April. Former employees, some of whom had worked at the restaurant for decades, confirmed the closure on social media. The news comes after Frisch's closed at St. Matthew's location in February. The Cincinnati-based company has 2 remaining Louisville area locations on Lincoln Avenue and Keystone Crossing in Shepherdsville. This concludes excerpts from the Courier-Journal for Monday, May 8th. Your reader has been Vicki Trupiano. Please stay tuned for continued programming on Radio I.